How do we draw people towards a deliciously sustainable future? Welcome to the Circular Economy Podcast. I'm your host, Catherine Wheatman, and I started this podcast to help people discover why circular, regenerative, and fair solutions are better for people, planet, and prosperity. Some people think going circular means swapping a few materials or making things a bit more recyclable. But that's nowhere near enough to create a healthy, resilient and zero carbon world where we can all thrive. Many organisations are missing the game-changing potential of going circular. The disruptors in this space are using circular strategies to reimagine how to create value for all their stakeholders. They're doing better with less. We'll hear from those inspiring people who are challenging business as usual and rethinking how we design, make and use everything. You'll find the show notes and links at circulareconomypodcast.com, where you can subscribe to podcast updates, my Circular Insights newsletter, and check out my award-winning A Circular Economy Handbook. Welcome to episode 129, and thank you for listening and for helping create a more circular, regenerative world. Today, we're going off at a slight tangent to explore how we can bring people into this world, to feel they have agency, and to see an exciting, meaningful future where we do better with less. We're going to hear about a way of telling stories. That could be fiction to help people understand circular solutions, or it might be stories to help them imagine how circular products and services work in real life, helping them see how that's more fulfilling than buying yet more stuff and adding to the problems of waste and pollution. Alex Holland is the founder of Solar Punk Stories. He's worked as a journalist in the UK, Venezuela and India. After that, he led the campaign to stop Brixton Market getting demolished in London, and then went on to represent Brixton Hill as a local government councillor. Alec has a master's in leadership for sustainable development and created the world's first tea pub, which was also Crowdcube's most shared startup. He loves reading and writing and describes himself as one of those lost tribes of posh people who was born in Brixton. Solar punk is a much more optimistic genre than dystopian fiction. It's more like the Thrutopian concept set out by Professor Rupert Read in an article for the Huffington Post a few years ago. Rupert Read says that the crisis is now so dire that mere reformism is useless. Being realistic now demands the politically impossible, needing a transformation of societal values and institutions more radical than has ever been seen before. He believes that grand technological utopias or purely localist utopias are no longer credible, and says what's desperately needed is artistic or philosophical vision that can show us how to avoid doom and gloom. And Reed says it's useless and even dangerously defeatist to wallow around in dystopias. So what do we do instead? We create Thrutopias, stories that help us see a way through the challenges we face, that help us build a vision for the future we want to be part of, a regenerative, fair and inclusive future that we can be proud of. Stories that help us to imagine, to feel what it would be like and to design the political and economic systems to get us through. Let's meet Alex Holland to discover what solar punk is all about and how it can help us draw people towards the circular economy. And I'll catch up with you afterwards to share what I took away from the conversation.
Well, Catherine, first, thank you so much for having me on your wonderful podcast. It's a total honour and a privilege. And to answer the, you know, what is solar punk? I mean, in a very simple sense, if solar punk is a sort of genre that comes with a movement, And really, it's defined in sort of opposition to the idea of cyberpunk. So, if cyberpunk was this vision of the future from the 1980s, where technology and corporations are just like run rampant and like taken over the world, so more or less what we're living in more like now. And so that was supposed to be, but the original authors of that, so this was a sort of nightmare future they wanted to avoid. Although many people, especially in Silicon Valley, actually looked at those texts and li literally told their employees, "This is what I want you to build." I mean, there's one case called Snow Crash. Anyway, so solarpunk is more about like, rather than the nightmarishly bad future we're trying to avoid, what is the deliciously sustainable future that we can that we would actually like to live in, and one that we say that the core things that, solarpunk is about is that it's, they say it's a, more sustainable, more socially just, and we've written a deep dive article basically saying what is solarpunk, one thing or many. And in that, what we argue is that there is, that's our core definition. We have an image of like a sun, and at the core of the sun, it's those things of socially just and more sustainable. But then we say there are many different shades besides that. So if you were to Google for solarpunk, to look on YouTube, you'd actually see some very visual depictions that are actually quite different from each other. So people can check that out if they're interested in that.
Yeah, I'll include a link to that in the show notes. So, could you give us a quick example of a story that would bring it to life for people?
Yes, so I'm the founder of something called Solarpunk Stories. So, and that's a volunteer-run storytelling society. And our first story series is called Solarpunk Detective. And the first episode of that is that it's Detective Inspector Russo is one of the last murder detectives left in this like solarpunk London of the 2060s. And there are so few murders that he's not even a full-time murder detective. He gets rotated on with these panels. And in that story, it's he and his colleague go to investigate the murder of someone who is a suspected black market queue jumper, it's called, because people have like personal carbon quotas that they can trade. But then these people and this these black marketeers hack the quotas and sell them illegally to other people, and they find this person, gruesomely murdered, and then an investigation can, goes from there.
Good stuff. So it's really kind of moving people into the future world, although I suppose we don't all want to be thinking about crime and what could happen, but this idea where trading carbon, reusing things, favouring pre-used things instead of buying new all the time, that just becomes normal. So helping people really imagine how good it would be to be in those kind of worlds where we're not controlled by corporates and we're not being constantly manipulated into how we spend our money. How did you come to be involved in solar punk stories? What brought you to this?
Great question, Catherine. Great question. So I was working in sustainability and for this sort of community engagement, diversity focused NGO. And I was part of this group of other campaigners who work for other NGOs. And I was talking to a wonderful friend of mine, Casper Tequil, a brilliant man. And I was saying about how I felt like so much of our campaigning was so about what we were trying to avoid, and we didn't really have any positive vision of our own. And he was like, "Oh, you've got to check out this report called Sell the Sizzle," which was made by a sustainability comms agency called Frutera. And it completely blew my mind. And in it, it really laid out, said that the climate change movement had been getting it totally wrong for the past 40 years, that they had been selling sort of climate breakdown hell when they should have been communicating deliciously sustainable heaven. And the reason why was they cited this psychological research, which showed, and neurocognitive research, which showed that fear-based motivation can be very effective, but it's when the threat is very clear and the path to avoid it is very clear. So if a train is coming at you, get off the train tracks, brilliant, brilliant. Fear is a wonderful tool. But if the threat is very large and diffuse and it's not clear how to avoid it, then what instead of action, it's more likely to trigger passivity and denialism. And it's more like your mind starts to close down because it's too awful, the prospect. But what was really good was they said, but they also showed a lot of evidence that said that, but if you can inspire people and excite them with like a vision of how great the future could be, it's a much more powerful form and sustainable form of motivator to get them to do like sustained, you know, pro climate action. And again, my undergraduate degree was in half in history, and that chimed with me, my analysis of sort of historical change movements, that, you know, Martin Luther King didn't say like, I have a nightmare. You know, it's like the most successful change movements had like a positive, inspiring vision as well as what they were against. So it's a combination. So I was really fired up by this report, and I shared it with this group the next meeting, expecting them all to be like, yes, it's amazing. And they were like, oh, it was terrible. They're like, this report is terrible. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they said, oh, well, we can't lie to people. We can't pretend that everything's going to be okay. And it was like, well, hang on. But the report's was very clear about that too. I mean, it was beautifully communicated, you know, by a professional marketing, sustainability marketing agency. And they even had this big box pull out section saying, and they're like, no, so don't try and deny bad things are going to happen. But it's like, that can't be your only message. And it's more like, if you can excite people first with the positive vision, and then say, if we don't do this, if we don't take action to make this happen, then there's also this really bad alternative. So anyway, so I left the meeting in disgust, and I was just feeling pretty down. And I did what I always do when I'm a bit down, which is I watched Star Trek, which is like my favorite TV show, and had a rum as well. And as I was watching that, and I felt despair, because I really did feel, I thought we'd just completely screwed, because these were the people in society, I thought, who were supposed to be really leading us. And if they were like so invested in the sort of business as usual doom narrative that they, you know, couldn't see the evidence that was presented in this brilliantly communicated report. But as I carried on watching the episode, the adventures of the Starship Enterprise, I realized, I was like, this is it. I was like, this is it. I was like, you know, it would be great if these NGO campaigners got this. But the shift really needs to take place at the level of popular imagination. And for that to happen, that really needs to happen in a broader way, through example, through art. And so then it was like, but we can't have it just like Star Trek, because even though I love it, I mean, I totally love Star Trek. But we can't have it because it's too far in the future. And also because they have transporters and phases and things like that, it's sort of like only when we have this sort of like super technology can we then live this better life. And I think that's completely wrong, that we, as Buckminster Fuller said decades ago, we already have all of the technology we need to create a sustainable, just, prosperous world. It's the things that need to change are the sort of cultural, economic, and political aspects of society, so that we can deploy that technology in a way that allows for flourishing for all life on this planet. So I was like, right, okay, it needs to be near Earth futures. The emphasis is less on tech, more on things like 21-hour working week, creative, rewarding, empowering work as the norm, you know, things like that. And then, but then I was like, oh, but if it's this radically better future setting that's super desirable, where's the drama going to come from? I mean, it could just end up being either dull or like sort of Soviet propaganda of like happy workers skipping into the, you know, the solar plant or whatever. I had all this happen in 2012. I had this idea and everything like that. And then had loads of other, but then I sort of parked the idea because I thought it was an art project. I need to sort out, you know, I'll do that when my other finances are a bit more sorted. But the years went by and it kept growing and building in me. And then my previous enterprise, which was I created the world's first tea pub, and it was a place with the atmosphere of a British pub, but instead of pints of beer, pots of tea. And we championed small tea growers and better ways of growing, and we provided work experience and job opportunities to ex-offenders. And long story short, one thing was, it was Crowdcube's most shared startup, had highest number of social media shares, loads of media, great launch. But then my business partner had a brain aneurysm and died, and which was horrible on a whole number of levels.
Gosh,
Basically, the
that
business
sounds so tough.
it was horrendous. But anyway, the business couldn't survive that, and I was basically then like. I was just reminded that life is too short to do something that you're not passionate about. And this had been building in me the whole time. I was like, I've got to do this project. The world needs this, da, da, da. And I thought, when the tea pub is more settled, I'll do this. So at that point, around the point, I was like, right, I'm going to do this. And that's when I heard the term solar punk, which was, just starting to come about that time. And I was like, and someone said, what you're doing is solar punk. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. Solar punk sounds cool. Yeah. So so that's when I set up Solar Punk Stories.
Brilliant. And yeah, so I've also read the report by Futera a few years ago, and yeah, I think I'll put a link in the show notes because I think it's still very relevant for people, to kind of get to grips with really. And you touched on a few aspects of this, but I've heard you talk before about this kind of story styles and how there can be different arcs going from happy to thrilling on one scale, and then from rooted in, more rooted in reality to more fantastical, which kind of comes back to the Star Trek story, doesn't it? So a kind of those two scales, happy to thrilling and rooted to fantastical. And where do you think to bring people into doing things as opposed to just visualizing this future and expecting it to just happen without all of us having to actively kind of push it forwards and do things that kind of help it become reality. Where do you think we need to be on those two scales?
I think it's much more that we should be on the more rooted, and I think it's a question of personal taste. But yeah, I think that. So basically, our shade of solar punk is a more rooted shade. So yes, it's the more is near Earth futures, within our lifetime, more credible technology, not like magical super technology. And it's more thrilling. So there's like conflict between characters, there's action, there's other things, and people might die, et cetera. But there's a whole other like section of solar punk fiction and art and stuff like that, where there's like no conflict at all, there's no action, nobody could die, and that's like, that's fine, if that's their thing. Then in terms of the rooted, yeah, I think that, we also did, so we did an audio reading event from Solar Punk Detective One, and we auditioned a lot of guys who were from, so I'm one of these lost tribes of posh people who was born in Brixton in the 80s and are very connected to that area. And we auditioned a lot of guys, and there is a guy who was from like a council estate, grew up a council estate in Brixton, and we read this, he was like, yeah, he's like, I love the story, but it's also like, this is in our lifetime, this could happen, we could make this, we could make this. Where if it's like, flying cars and, hundreds of years in the future and such, like, it's, well, it's also, I guess also the other part of that is that that's less, my idea of the better future is not really mega skyscrapers and flying cars and asteroid mining. It's shorter working week, more ability to participate in effective forms of local democracy. you know, thriving communities. It's all of those type of things that are the more, you know, the things that really appeal to me more than that. So yes.
Yeah. So less of the work and buy, and more of the kind of, you know, community and living. Kind of really, really valuing what we bring to each other, not getting hoodwinked into thinking that status is and you know, being part of our community is all about what we wear or what we've bought or what car we drive or whatever.
So I just to interrupt you, but I think for us it's the essence of the good future that we are going to build together, I believe, is where prosperity is defined more by the quality of the experiences and relationships we enjoy rather than the quantity of crap that we consume. And that is the fundamental. And it's, and in essence, part of the thing in the first story is that in the solar punk detective future, the norm is like clothes are rented rather than bought. So it's very expensive to buy clothes outright, and rent is the norm. And you're trying to change the systems in that way, where you can still have like a varied wardrobe of extremely like nice clothes, so but in a way that is not like destroying the planet.
Yeah, and in a way that provides interesting, well-paid jobs for the people who are making and selling those things, because that's the big disconnect now, isn't it? That people are persuaded to consume stuff that's, you know, made using slave labor. But that whole thing, that whole aspect of it is just completely obscured. Not hidden, because you can go looking for it, but it's you know, it's kind of under the surface, and we're encouraged to not even start to think about it. So you've talked about renting clothes. Are there any other examples of the circular economy that are kind of popping up in solar punk stories?
So in the next episode of Solar Punk Detective, there's going to be a very, not just circular, but like closed loop system. But it's going to be in a really thrilling context. So it's going to, it sounds really boring, but, and I don't want to spoil the story before it drops, but you know, it's like an action scene where someone could die, but through the drama of the action scene and the set of this, you know, where they're fighting, it conveys how, you know, yeah, it's like a fully circular system in Brixton Market for what happens with the food waste. So I'm not going to say any more than that. But I guess the other thing that is there in the first episode is that a lot of people have these things called MODs, which are like short for modular communication devices. And the idea is that essentially like smartphones are incorporated into pieces of jewelry, and the tech is upgraded. So D.I. Russo has a pocket watch, but someone else might have like a necklace or like a bracelet. And that came from, I did my master's in leadership for sustainable development with Forum for the Future. And there was some research they did around that. And it was like, you know, in a sense, how can you have all the utility of a smartphone, but not want to upgrade the hardware every year, partly because your, you know, phone providers pushed it. And to try and attach that emotional attachment to the hardware, that it was something that you cherished, and like the longer you had it, like the more that you would want it. So you wouldn't want to like get rid of the, you know, the casing. And so this was that the idea came from there. And that's another thing that features in the first story.
Yeah. And, you know, that's being done in various fields now, isn't it? Fairphone. You know, here's my Fairphone 3, which I turned into a 3 plus by using the money I got for recycling my Fairphone 2 from Fairphone to buy the much better camera lens that came with the Fairphone 3 plus. And that was the only difference. So in a few minutes and with a single screwdriver, I'd done the upgrade myself, and you know, and then that's really increased my emotional attachment to the phone and made me feel really good about, you know, the fact that I'd bought secondhand to start with the Fairphone 3, but I'd still got the functionality that I wanted. So yeah, and when you were talking about the various you know, the happy to thrilling and rooted to fantastical, and I was thinking about some research that I'd read, which said that if people spend too much energy on visualizing their goals, whatever that's for, whether it's, you know, about sustainability or something else. But there's a problem where you can kind of back off the motivation because you've visualized it so much and so nicely that you've conned yourself into believing that you've already done it. And I suppose there's also this thing of, you know, if other people are doing this, we can just sit back and it's going to happen without us having to make an effort. So it's kind of getting this balance, isn't it, that it's enough to make people to pull people towards it so powerfully that they want to go out and help it happen more quickly. And I'm thinking, you know, if there are researchers listening, this is something that we could really do with researching, is, you know, where on those two scales is the ideal. And for those of us trying to create not just, you know, not necessarily solar punk stories, but stories about the circular disruptive businesses, you know, how to get those into the forefront, stories that could go into newspapers, bringing together what's actually happening and making that future a bit more real, if only people go out and choose to do, to rent clothes, to upgrade their phones, whatever it is. So how do we find this optimal balance where people do take different actions afterwards? And I think it would be great if researchers would, you know, do some work looking at people reading stories and seeing films and that kind of thing, and then following up over the next year or so to see what people do differently. We kind of need the science, don't we, to tell us here's the sweet spot for everybody trying to write the new story and pull people towards this more connected and regenerative future.
Well, I think the first port of call to check if that's already been done somewhere is Katie Patrick, right. And she has a wonderful podcast. It's called How to Save the World, and she just focuses overwhelmingly on academic psychological research to help motivate pro sustainable behavior. So that's like overwhelmingly what her channel is about.
Yeah, well, that sounds good, and I'll look her up and put a link to her podcast in the show notes. Alex, how's solarpunk gaining traction, and what plans have you got to help it grow?
I mean, I think one of the ways that we also want to help champion solarpunk, even if it's not necessarily the called solarpunk, but if it's the essence of this thing of like, how can we inspire, you know, this deliciously sustainable future, is to tell the stories, the founding stories of mission-led businesses that are doing something sustainability-wise. They don't have to be perfect right now, because it's almost impossible to be perfect when the system is so unsustainable, but it's got to be sincere. They can't just be greenwashers. And by telling the founding stories of how those came about and building that human connection between what they do and why they started it, to build not only the trust and the credibility with, you know, their customers and supporters, but there's psychological research which has shown that people are 22 times more likely to share information that is presented as a story than they are if it's just presented as a, you know, this is what we do, blah blah blah. And in that way, you know, we can help show, because what we call that is like, you know, these enterprises that are like solar punking it right now. So part of the idea is that, you know, there are seeds or examples of these types of businesses everywhere doing great stuff, but a lot of them as well, you know, because they're small or it's not their specialism, they struggle to cut through the noise in terms of marketing wise. And again, it's sort of like by telling the founding story in a way that works, it's basically a very cost effective way to like cut through the noise, get noticed, get shared with the right type of people, with the people who actually like what you're about and what you're going to do.
And the people who are more likely to either support you as an investor or buy from you or tell all their friends about this brilliant business that they've just come across. And that's what these disruptive businesses need. So, yeah. So that sounds like, is this the new service that you've been talking about? And how would people find out about that?
Well, you could hopefully share a link in the podcast. So it's my it's currently under the name of Merlin Branding, which is my marketing business. And part of the idea was that it was Merlin telling the story of how Arthur took the sword from the stone is what helped, you know, his people realize that he was the servant king that they needed, you know, to help them redeem the land. So yes, that's the idea of it. And so they could find out about it that way.
Right.
Yes, and I was just to follow up on your point about the investors, I think it's especially valuable for people trying to raise money in that way because as I mentioned about the, you know, we were the most funded startup on Crowdcube doing the T-Pub. But the thing that people kept saying again and again was, oh my God, the way you told the story of how the business came about, that was the thing. And there was one person who invested £10,000 without ever meeting me or talking or taking, you know, wanting the business plan, just on the basis of that, just on the basis of the story, the founding story.
Yeah, and wanting to put some money into helping make it a reality, not just a great pitch.
And I think one of the examples is that we worked with this wonderful chap called Joseph, who's got a project called Solarpunk VC, and he's looking to invest in sort of solarpunk-worthy startups. But if you looked at his site, you could get the feeling like, oh, is this just some Silicon Valley tech bro who is just going to want to, like, you know, be really exploitative and extractive and 10x and all that jazz. And it was only when I took the meeting with him and, you know, and heard his story and then realized, you know, though his background is in tech, he is so far from being, you know, this type of guy. I mean, the fact is the reason why he started Solarpunk VC was because he was so disenchanted with that tech world that he ended up, you know, taking a break and he hiked the Appalachian Trail, which is like thousands of miles or something like that in the States. And he was really humbled by like the generosity of these very poor communities that were there. And a lot of them didn't have internet and the nature that he saw. And he came through that, you know, and he thought, like, how can I use my skills that I've gained from this world of tech and, you know, but in a way that nurtures, you know, like community, nature. And that's how he came to Solarpunk VC. And, you know, and thus you're more likely to, you know, apply to his fund or take a call with him if you are, you know, a conscious entrepreneur.
Yeah. So his heart's really driving it. And that would help, you know, telling that story helps connect him to people who have similar driving forces, you know, rather than it being, you know, how much money can we make out of this this new circular trend. So, Alex, I'm conscious of time. So let's move on to the quickfire questions, if we may. And we've talked a little bit about circular economy, but do you have a favorite circular economy example that you'd like to share?
My favorite example is a platform called Sojo, and it's set up by this very inspiring young entrepreneur who went to King's College London, which also was my undergraduate college, but many, many years previous to her. And what it does is it's basically their premise is that, you know, you buy something in this pre-loved clothing, and it might be vintage and you think, oh God, this is gorgeous, but it doesn't quite fit you very well. So what they do is that they connect, you know, people who've got clothes that need alterations with seamstresses that are local to their area. And then they facilitate, like, you know, the pickup and the alterations and that sort of stuff. And I mean, I just completely love, besides that, I love fashion. I'm a guest lecturer or associate lecturer at London College of Fashion in marketing and enterprise. But what I really love about it is how, you know, not only is it that it's encouraging, it's removing one of the obstacles or one of the problems of buying things, clothing that's pre-loved, but the fact that they're connecting it with people who are like the local seamstress. So I have my own, I call her my tailor, Queenie, who's in it. But she has this tiny, tiny unit in Brixton Market, and she dresses in these like gorgeous Eritrean clothes. And but the fact that it would be connecting, you know, and helping like enrich and, you know, empower, you know, people like Queenie, who Queenie's not going to run a social media account to try and get more customers, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah,
so,
it's helping bring her into a marketplace that she'd have had no contact with. And I guess also the having alterations done improves the amount of emotional attachment that people then have to those vintage clothes, and particularly because somebody with amazing skills has done that for you, it kind of all builds it up, doesn't it, to be something that's much more than the sum of its parts.
I mean, it's massively, I don't know if you're going to produce the camera of this, but if you can see, so this jacket, which is a Burberry, the cuff was fraying, and so Queenie, I got this Ghanaian fabric from Brixton Market, and she put the trim on, and now I just love this jacket so much more. And I actually was on off Savile Row, there's a place called German Street, which is more for classical tailoring, and all these tailors in this shop were like, whoa, how'd you get that done? Oh, it looks amazing. And they brought guys out from the back of the shop to come, and they're like, check this out, look at what he's done with this Burberry. Everyone's like, so, and yes, of course, and I think of Queenie as well every time I see it, and her wonderful smile. Yes.
Yeah, and it's, you know, individualizing things is a great way of making a statement, because you're now saying, you know, I've kept something going for longer, I've cared for this, and I've put my own stamp on it, and, you know, a really good tailor's helped make it look brilliant. And it, you know, just says so many different things, doesn't it? And Alex, if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing to help create a better world, what would that be?
A much shorter working week as the norm. So it would be, again, a wonderful report done by the New Economics Foundation some years ago, and said the, you know, the case for a 21-hour working week, combined with some wealth redistribution that would have to happen, so that, you know, donut economics style, no one should fall below a certain level of prosperity. But I think that, back to the thing I said before about how really, I think the real essence of the world we want to build, even if there wasn't climate change or breakdown, you know, even if that wasn't an issue, it really is, it's prosperity being more about the quality of the experience and relationships rather than the quantity of crap we consume. And I think that having, you know, if to live in a more sustainable world, you know, we're going to have a lot less consumerism, which is going to benefit our well-being anyway, as all the research shows. But in a sense, if you were to think like, okay, maybe you're not upgrading your phone every 6 months, but you have a, you know, you only work on average 3 days a week, it's like, would you take that deal? It's like, yes. Hello. And then all the other flourishing that could allow and facilitate in society. And actually, as I should mention as well, there's a brilliant campaign 4-day week campaign here, which has been doing, and there's an international version as well, but the British one, they have been doing amazing work, and they did a pilot with dozens and dozens of companies, and the vast majority of those companies have decided to keep the pilot going even without any government subsidies and such like. You know, they've seen so many gains in terms of the satisfaction of their workforce and such like, and their productivity. So, but I think on the societal level, it would also have, you know, huge benefits, which are laid out in the New Economics Foundation report.
Yeah, I think the idea's got so much potential. And again, it's the kind of thing that people could, that could draw people towards a different future. Like you said, you know, would you trade upgrading your iPhone every 6 months for a 3D, you know, of course. So getting people to start thinking about how this consumption lifestyle locks us in to having to work all these hours and by kind of be a wage slave is one of the one of the sort of mindset changes that could unlock lots of things. And the kind of how do we fund this for people, if people haven't heard episode 119, so not all that long ago, but with Ken Webster, one of the leading thinkers in the circular economy, talking about the circular economy. So not the kind of, you know, the businesses, the products and materials, but how do we make the economy circular? So he talked about an idea from the Club of Rome and Earth for All of this universal basic dividend. So where companies are utilizing things that are really in the commons, so that could be metals and minerals, fossil fuels, but even things like water, you know, people turn water from aquifers into mineral water and sell it for a load of money, but that really, that water is a part of the global commons.
Just the only other last thing on the shorter working week, the report said there would be huge savings from all the health gains, all the social care gains, you know, all these other things where if people could spend the time, more time with their families and the communities, you know, doing things, that there'd be big, big, you know, big gains in terms of to the exchequer. But anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reminded of that phrase that, you know, nobody ever lies on their deathbed with the regret that they didn't spend more time in at work. So, Alex, before we let people know how they can discover Solarpunk online, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Just how wonderful it is that you have been, you know, keeping this podcast thriving for so long, and what an achievement it is. Because, I mean, I know it's a lot of work, and I think it's great that you're putting the case out there for the circular economy and helping circular businesses feel that they're not alone, you know, and that they're part of a broader movement. And I do think, you know, that it is key that, you know, each one in our own small way, you know, by joining up together for action together, by sharing our stories, you know, we can help inspire other people as well to do the right thing. And in particular, what we really need as well is to get politicians and government to be realizing that there's so much value in these concepts and in these movements, and we need to ignore the vested interests of the outdated polluting system and move towards this deliciously sustainable, I would even say, solarpunk future.
Yeah, I think you're so right. And it's a shame that our politicians seem to have so little imagination about what the future could hold and how that could be so much better for all of us. But yeah, thanks for your feedback on the podcast. So how can people find out more and get in touch with you and your Storytelling for Founders project and Solarpunk?
So for the Storytelling for Founders, if they go to www.merlinbranding.com, so like the wizard Merlin, and branding like what makes you stand out and people know that you are the answer to their problems and their beloved friend. That's the so that would be for the Founding Story Service. And then for Solarpunk Stories, for the to engage with some of the stories in the fiction and buy Solarpunk Detective, that's www.solarpunkstories.com. And we also have a fortnightly Substack newsletter and blog, which you know, it's there's buttons to sign up to that all over the website. So so just if you go on the website, just, you know, click away to get that. And on that, as well as, you know, we try and look at solarpunk art and fiction and movies. We're doing a series right now on like what are solarpunk films, but we do a lot of exploring people solarpunking it right now. So we look at things like regenerative agriculture, but we also do look into businesses and enterprises that we want to like try and showcase and projects as well. And we'll probably be doing more of that in the future.
Brilliant. So lots for people to go and explore and discover and find this new genre. Well, not so new, but probably new to lots of people, of solarpunk stories. So, Alex, solarpunk sounds like a really great way to help people imagine this better, fairer, more circular world, as you term it, deliciously sustainable world. And I'm reminded of what Walt Disney apparently said, that if you can dream it, you can do it. So thanks so much for introducing us to the world of solarpunk stories.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you.
I love the way Alex described the essence of solarpunk, the deliciously sustainable future that we can and that we'd actually like to live in, a future that's both more sustainable and more socially just. What also struck me was the idea of the Matrix, marking out the style of solarpunk stories, which has two scales. One scale goes from happier to thrilling, the other scale from being more fantastical to more rooted. As Alex explained, stories that are more fantastical could feel too far away or improbable, and so may be less likely to spark people's imaginations, so they feel the story is possible in real life, rooted in real life. And I feel that's the most important lesson from this, for us to consider how we paint pictures that people want to make real, through utopian stories that fire people with agency and energy, that help us see the failures and downsides of the systems and worldviews we're going along with, and to envisage a better way. We need stories to pull us through this, to help us imagine a future where we do so much better with much less exploitation, pollution, and harm. We need to tell stories that pull people towards more local, circular, regenerative, inclusive, and fair ways of living and working. I've included links to Rupert Reed's Throughtopia article, Futera's Sell the Sizzle report, Sojo and Solarpunk VC, and to the solarpunk resources that Alex mentioned, including that deep dive article, What is Solarpunk? One Thing or Many? The article includes that story matrix and dives into the subgenres of solarpunk. So it may spark some ideas for how you tell stories that draw people towards a circular future or to your circular product or service. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Circular Economy Podcast, and huge thanks to our inspiring guest, Alex Holland, founder of Solarpunk Stories. You can find out more about Alex Holland and check out all the other links we mentioned in the show notes at circulareconomypodcast.com. The Circular Economy Podcast is brought to you by Rethink Global, the company I started to help you succeed with circular. You can find information on my talks, workshops and advice, plus circular economy resources at rethinkglobal.info. And you can connect with me, Catherine Wheatman, on LinkedIn. I believe we can all help make the circular economy happen through the choices we make at work and in our everyday lives. Buying pre-used, keeping what we have for longer, repairing it, and making sure it has another life. Those choices send strong signals to companies and governments, making it clear we all want a better, circular, and regenerative future. We can do better with less. We can all help spread the word too, talk about the circular economy, and help other people find this podcast by leaving us a rating and a review on your podcast app. If you're just starting out with the circular economy, why not check out our Getting Started playlist on the podcast homepage? You could also buy my award-winning book, A Circular Economy Handbook, How to Build a More Resilient, Competitive and Sustainable Business. It takes you through the concepts and practicalities with hundreds of real examples from all around the world. We've made it easier for you to find episodes on the key circular economy strategies, or for a market sector, or specific countries. Check out the Interactive Podcast Index. There's a link on the podcast homepage at circulareconomypodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening to the end, and if you like what you're hearing, please hit subscribe. And I'll see you next time.